This is Artificially Intelligent News for Thursday, August 20th, 2026. I'm Mark Ellison. This AI-created program has been fact-checked against current reporting and official information available this morning. The United States and Canada are working toward a trade agreement that would avert threatened new U.S. tariffs. President Trump had threatened 50% tariffs on about $20 billion in Canadian imports. The tariffs are now postponed until 12:01 Saturday morning while negotiators try to finalize documents. A senior Canadian official described the emerging arrangement as a good deal for Canada, but stressed that negotiations are not complete. The official said Ottawa expects its dairy system and jobs threatened by the tariffs to be protected. President Trump said the agreement would be fair to both countries and beneficial to American farmers and manufacturers. The details matter because the threatened tariffs would cover roughly 5% of Canadian exports to the United States. They were tied to disputes involving access for American autos, alcohol, and dairy products. Canada's trade minister says its agricultural sector remains protected until a final text is public. This is a pause in a tariff dispute, not a completed trade agreement. Cross-border trade is closely integrated, so even a temporary tariff threat can affect purchasing decisions and supply plans on both sides of the border. The extension gives negotiators room, but it also leaves businesses waiting for terms that will show which products, if any, face higher duties. In a major media law fight, Disney has sued the Federal Communications Commission. The company says the agency's early review of 8 ABC local broadcast licenses is retaliation for constitutionally protected speech, including satire by ABC host Jimmy Kimmel. FCC Chairman Brendan Carr has defended the review. He says broadcasters have a duty to operate in the public interest, and that the agency is restoring that standard. Disney argues in its lawsuit that the review creates an existential threat to its stations and could chill speech by other media companies. That is now a court dispute, not a judicial finding. Disney is alleging a First Amendment violation. The FCC has not conceded that characterization. The case is consequential because broadcast licenses are essential to local ABC stations and because it tests the line between regulatory oversight and government pressure on editorial decisions. The FCC's license renewal process normally examines whether stations meet public interest obligations. Disney's challenge focuses not on the agency's power to conduct licensing reviews, but on the timing and motive it attributes to this one. That distinction is likely to be central as the case moves forward. At the Food and Drug Administration, President Trump says he has selected Dr. Heidi Overton to lead the agency. Overton is a physician and deputy director of the White House Domestic Policy Council. She has worked on several second-term health initiatives and is regarded as a trusted administration figure. The FDA oversees the safety and approval of medicines, vaccines, medical devices, and much of the nation's food supply. A permanent commissioner is one of the most consequential public health appointments in Washington. The formal nomination and Senate process will determine whether Overton takes the post and give lawmakers an opportunity to question her approach to regulation, scientific evidence, and agency independence. FDA decisions shape what treatments reach patients, what information accompanies them, and how manufacturers are supervised. That is why the position draws attention from industry, medical groups, and lawmakers even before a nominee reaches a confirmation hearing. A federal judge has blocked the administration's plan to move FBI headquarters into the Ronald Reagan Building in Washington. The decision restores momentum to the previously approved plan for a new FBI headquarters in Greenbelt, Maryland. U.S. District Judge Theodore Chuang ruled that the administration's reversal of the Maryland plan was not in accordance with law. He barred the government from moving the FBI to the Reagan Building, renovating it for that purpose, or repurposing the money involved. Maryland and Prince George's County brought the case. State officials say they spent more than a decade pursuing the project and committed hundreds of millions of dollars. The FBI criticized the ruling and said it would continue seeking what it calls the best course for law enforcement. For now, the decision blocks a major change to the Bureau's long-delayed headquarters plan. Another federal court decision is affecting the Justice Department in Nevada. The Ninth Circuit has ruled that Sigel Chadha was unlawfully appointed to lead federal prosecutions in the state. Chadha was initially named interim U.S. attorney, but was not confirmed by the Senate. After her temporary term expired, she resigned and was made first assistant U.S. attorney, while the administration maintained that she could keep performing the top prosecutor's role. The appeals court rejected that position. She remains in the office with the title of first assistant, while the broader legal consequences continue to be sorted out. The White House has selected George Kilasis as a replacement, but he still must go through Senate confirmation. The decision follows similar legal setbacks for the administration's efforts to extend the service of hand-picked prosecutors beyond statutory limits. At the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, new director Dr. Erica Schwartz has acknowledged serious staffing problems at programs funded by Congress. In her first large meeting with employees, she said she would advocate for the agency and recognize that workers are burned out. A recent review found that several CDC programs have congressional funding but little or no staff to do the work. They include initiatives involving Alzheimer's disease, smoking prevention, epilepsy, sickle cell data collection, and rape prevention. Some specialists were laid off during administration cost cuts. Others remain on paid leave during legal disputes. Schwartz said she intends to meet with staff to learn what can be done. She also said she would not hesitate to disagree with Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. when necessary, though she said she would handle disagreements privately. The immediate question is whether an agency can carry out Congress's public health directives when the money remains, but the workforce does not. Funding alone does not run a public health program. Many initiatives depend on specialists to manage grants, collect data, coordinate with states, and keep prevention work moving. The shortfall, then, is operational as well as financial. In technology, OpenAI has introduced ChatGPT for teens, a version intended for users ages 13 through 17. The company says it has stronger restrictions around self-harm, suicide, and romantic or sexual conversations. It also offers study help meant to guide learning rather than simply generate school assignments. Teen accounts are intended to receive added protections by default when a user is identified as under 18. Parents and guardians who link an account can set quiet hours and receive limited safety notifications in high-risk circumstances. OpenAI says those controls do not give parents access to a teen's chats. The announcement comes amid rising concern from families, schools, and child development specialists over young people's reliance on AI chatbots. Advocates welcomed additional safeguards but said their effectiveness will need to be tested in real use. The central issue is not whether teenagers will encounter AI. They already do. It is whether the guardrails are strong enough for a product that may be used for schoolwork, personal questions, and companionship. OpenAI says age prediction systems help assign appropriate protections, and that a user who believes the teen setting is wrong can take steps to verify age. The company is trying to balance privacy, education, and safety in a field where real-world evidence is still developing. Outside the United States, renewed violence is placing added strain on Gaza's already fragile ceasefire. Gaza health officials and the Palestinian Red Crescent said at least 10 people were killed in two Israeli strikes on Wednesday. Israel said one strike targeted a Hamas commander involved in the October 7, 2023 attack on Israel, while another targeted militants it said were planning attacks on Israeli troops. Israeli troops also crossed the ceasefire line in southern Gaza and detained a Hamas police colonel, according to witnesses and a Hamas official. The developments came shortly after Jared Kushner, a U.S. negotiator and President Trump's son-in-law, met Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and urged a drawdown in attacks, according to a person familiar with that meeting. The competing accounts and casualty figures reflect the difficulty of reporting from an active conflict zone. What is clear is that the ceasefire has reduced but not ended violence. The diplomatic challenge remains unresolved. Israel says Hamas must disarm before it will withdraw further, while the humanitarian and security stakes for Gaza's civilian population remain severe. The reported detention underscores that the ceasefire line has not produced a settled security arrangement on the ground. Each strike or military movement can raise the risk of escalation and complicate negotiations over disarmament, withdrawals, and the ceasefire's next stage. In Northeast Asia, the United States and South Korea have cut short their annual Ulchi Freedom Shield exercises. The drills will now end Friday rather than August 27th. Some joint field training has also been reduced, canceled, or converted into simulations. President Trump ordered the reduction, citing his relationship with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, the cost of the exercises, and South Korea's refusal to support his Iran policy. South Korean officials said the move came without prior notice, which prompted concerns about readiness. The Pentagon says essential training objectives will be preserved. North Korea, for its part, dismissed the reductions and continued to describe the exercises as dangerous. The drills are largely command post simulations, but they are a central part of the U.S.-South Korean alliance and have long been opposed by Pyongyang. The change will be watched closely for its effect on deterrence and alliance confidence. Military exercises do more than provide practice. They test communication, coordination, and the ability of the two forces to respond together. That makes their scale and timing politically sensitive, especially when a decision changes without notice to an ally. Now to the economy and markets. These are final closes from Wednesday's completed U.S. trading session, not futures or intraday readings. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 119.65 points, or 0.2%, to close at 53,463.05. The S&P 500 added 16.22 points, also 0.2%, finishing at 7,707.98. The NASDAQ Composite gained 41.38 points, or 0.2%, to close at 26,331.09. Stocks gained after the Treasury Department said it would more than double planned purchases of longer-term Treasury securities between September 9th and November 4th. The stated aim is to improve liquidity in longer-dated Treasury markets. Long-term yields had risen through the summer amid concerns about inflation, large government debts, and budget deficits. Higher yields raise borrowing costs for households, businesses, and governments, and can pressure stock valuations. After the Treasury announcement, the 10-year yield fell to 4.64% from 4.71% late Tuesday. It remained well above the 3.97% level reported before the Iran war pushed oil prices and inflation worries higher. The move is not a Federal Reserve interest rate cut. It is a Treasury market operation aimed at liquidity and borrowing market stress. Investors will be watching whether it provides durable relief, especially if inflation expectations, energy costs, and federal borrowing needs stay elevated. Treasury purchases are separate from its regular issuance of new debt. By increasing its presence in the market for existing longer-term securities, the department is seeking smoother trading. The immediate reaction was lower yields, although the action cannot remove all the forces that have been pushing rates higher. In sports, the college football preseason picture is set. Ohio State is number one in the Associated Press top 25, with Oregon at number two. It is the first time in 65 years that one conference has held the top two preseason spots. Ohio State received 40 first-place votes, and Oregon received 14. Georgia, Notre Dame, and Texas round out the top five. Defending national champion Indiana begins at number six, followed by Miami, Texas A&M, Mississippi, and Oklahoma. The SEC leads the poll with 9 ranked teams, while the Big Ten is seeking a fourth straight college football playoff championship after titles by Michigan, Ohio State, and Indiana. The preseason poll does not decide anything, but it establishes the early national expectations. Ohio State faces a demanding schedule that includes a September visit to Texas, plus conference games against several ranked opponents. Oregon begins with the highest preseason ranking in school history. For Ohio State and Oregon, the rankings place immediate attention on two programs expected to contend nationally before a game is played. For Indiana, the number six ranking illustrates how crowded the title race is expected to be. College football is also confronting a sharper version of the question that has changed the sport: when does name, image, and likeness compensation become pay-for-play? An Associated Press examination notes that elite college linemen can command deals worth millions of dollars, sums that many established NFL players at the same position do not receive in endorsements. The NCAA still formally distinguishes third-party NIL arrangements from salaries for playing, but that distinction is under mounting pressure as schools and collectives compete for talent. The system has created opportunities for athletes, while also remaking recruiting, roster management, and the economic balance among programs. With the season approaching, that tension is no longer a side story. It is part of the structure of the sport. A quick results check in Major League Baseball: the Yankees beat the Orioles 5-3. The Mets defeated the Padres 4-2. The Phillies beat the Marlins 4-1. Minnesota topped Atlanta 6-4. And in flag football, the United States men and Canada women won world titles, earning places in the Los Angeles Olympics. That result is another marker of the sport's growth as it moves toward its Olympic debut. Finally, a significant figure in American sports media has died. Bill Rasmussen, the co-founder of ESPN, died Tuesday at his Florida home from the effects of Parkinson's disease. He was 93. Rasmussen and his son Scott developed the idea for a 24-hour sports cable network after Rasmussen lost his job with the World Hockey Association's New England Whalers. With financial backing from Getty Oil and an NCAA rights agreement, ESPN launched on September 7, 1979, from a studio in Bristol, Connecticut that was still under construction. The first sports center preceded a slow-pitch softball game. The concept that once drew skepticism from cable operators helped transform how Americans watch sports, creating a round-the-clock news and live events business that now spans television, streaming, and social media. Rasmussen and his family did not remain in control of ESPN for long, but his original idea changed the culture of sports media. Rasmussen's death is a reminder that the modern sports news cycle did not emerge fully formed. ESPN's bet was that there could be an audience for sports coverage at every hour, long before streaming made constant access commonplace. That is the briefing for this Thursday morning. We covered the U.S.-Canada trade talks, the Disney FCC lawsuit, Gaza, public health, markets, and the opening shape of college football. Please follow Artificially Intelligent News and share this calm morning briefing with one person who would value it. I'm Mark Ellison. Thanks for listening.